in the court. Perhaps she would. So Kasha and I went down to hover outside the great council chamber. The queen was there again, a part of the wall council now. The guards would have let me inside. They knew who I was now. They watched me sidelong out of the corners of their eyes, nervous and interested both, as though I might erupt with more sorcery at any moment, like contagious boils. But I didn't want to go in. I didn't want to get caught up in the arguments of the magnati and the generals, planning how best to murder 10,000 men and harvest glory while the crops rotted in the fields. I wasn't going to put myself into their hands as another weapon to aim. So we waited outside and held back against the wall instead, while the consul came pouring out, a torrent of lords and soldiers. I had thought the queen would come behind them, with servants to help her walk. But she didn't. She came out in the center of the crowd. She was wearing the circlet, Ragastok's circlet, the one he'd been working on. The gold caught the light, and the rubies shone above her golden hair. She wore red silk too, and all the courtiers gathered around her, sparrows around a cardinal bird. It was the king who came behind the rest, talking in low voices with Father Balo and two counselors, an afterthought. Kasha looked at me. We would have had to shove through the crowd to get to her, brazen. But we could have done it. Kasha could have made a way for us. But the queen looked so different. The stiffness seemed to have faded. And her silence. She was nodding to the lords around her. She was smiling. She was one of them again. One of the actors moving on the stage. As graceful as any of them. I didn't move. She glanced aside for a moment. Almost towards us. I didn't try to catch her eye. Instead, I caught Kasha's arm and pressed her farther back into the wall with me. Something held me, like the instinct of a mouse in a hole, hearing the breath of the owl's wing overhead. The guards fell in after the court with the last looks at me. The hallway stood empty. I was trembling.
"Neshka," Kasha said, "what is it?"
"I've made a mistake," I said. I didn't know just what, but I'd done something wrong. I felt the dreadful certainty of it sinking down through me, like watching a penny falling away down a deep well. I've made a mistake. Kasha followed me through the hallways, the narrow stairs, almost running by the end, back to my small room. She was watching me, worried, while I shut the door hard behind us and leaned against it, like a child hiding.
"Was it the queen?" Kasha said.
I looked at her standing in the middle of my room, firelight golden on her skin and through her hair, and for one horrible moment she was a stranger wearing Kasha's face. For one moment I'd brought the dark in with me. I whirled away from her to the table. I'd brought a few branches of pine into my bedroom, to have them nearby. I took a handful of needles and burned them on the hearth and breathed in the smoke, the sharp, bitter smell, and I whispered my cleansing spell. The strangeness faded. Kasha was sitting on the bed, watching me, unhappy. I looked up at her miserably. She'd seen suspicion in my eyes.
"It's no more than I thought myself," she said. "Neshka, I should... maybe the queen, maybe both of us, should be..."
Her voice shook. "No," I said. "No." But I didn't know what to do. I sat on the hearth, panting, afraid, and then I turned abruptly to the fire, cupping my hands, and I called up my old practice illusion, the small and determinedly thorny rose, the vining branches of the rose bush, climbing sluggishly over the sides of the fire screen. Slowly singing, I gave it perfume, and a handful of humming bees, and leaves curling at the edges, with ladybugs hiding. And then I made Sarkan on the other side of it. I called up his hands beneath mine,
the long, spindly, careful fingers, the smooth rubbed pen calluses, the heat of his skin radiating. And he took shape on the hearth, sitting beside me, and we were sitting in his library too. I was singing my short illusion spell, back and forth, feeding a steady silver thread of magic to it. But it wasn't like the heart tree had been the day before. I was looking at his face, his frown, his dark eyes scowling at me, but it wasn't really him. It wasn't just an illusion that I needed. Not just the image of him, or even a smell, or a sound, I realized. That wasn't why the heart tree had lived down in that throne room. It had grown out of my heart, out of fear and memory, and the churning of horror in my belly. The rose was cupped in my hands. I looked at Sarkhan, on the other side of the petals, and let myself feel his hands cupped around mine. The places where his fingertips just barely brushed against my skin, and where the heels of my palms rested in his. I let myself remember the alarming heat of his mouth, the crush of his silk and lace between our bodies, his whole length against me. And I let myself think about my anger, about everything I'd learned, about his secrets and everything he'd hidden. I let go of the rose, and gripped the edges of his coat to shake him, to shout at him, to kiss him. And then he blinked and looked at me. And there was fire glowing somewhere behind him. His cheek was grimy with soot, flecks of ash in his hair, and his eyes were reddened. The fire on the hearth crackled, and it was the distant crackle of fire in the trees. "Well?" he demanded, hoarse and irritated. And it was him. "We can't do this for long. Whatever you are doing, I can't have my attention divided." My hands clenched on the fabric. I felt stitches going ragged and flecks of stinging ash on my hands, ash in my nostrils, ash in my mouth. "What's happening?" "The wood's trying to take Zatochik," he said. "We've been burning it back every day. But we've lost a mile of ground already. Vladimir has sent what soldiers he could spare from the Yellow Marshes, but it's not enough. Is the king sending any men?"
"No,"
I said.
They're starting another war with Rossiya. The queen said Vasily of Rossiya gave her to the wood."
"The queen spoke?" he said sharply, and I felt the same uneasy drumbeat of fear rise up in my throat again.
"But the falcon put a spell of seeing on her," I said, arguing with myself as much as him. "They tried her with Jadwiga's shawl. There wasn't anything in her. There wasn't a trace. None of them could see any shadow."
"Corruption isn't the only tool the wood has," Sarkhan said. "Ordinary torment can break a person just as well. It might have let her go deliberately, broken to its service, but untainted to any magical sight. Or it might have planted something on her instead, or nearby. A fruit, a seed." He stopped and turned his head, seeing something I couldn't. He said sharply, "Let go," and jerked his magic loose. I fell backwards off the hearth, and struck against the floor, jarred painfully. The rose bush crumbled to ash on the hearth and vanished, and he was gone with it. Kasha sprang to catch me, but I was already scrambling to my feet. "A fruit, a seed." His words had sparked fear in me. "The bestiary," I said. "Balo was going to try to purify it." I was still dizzy, but I turned and ran from the room, urgency rising in me. Balo had been going to tell the king about the book. Kasha ran beside me, steadying my first wobbly steps. The screaming reached us as we plunged down the first narrow servant's staircase. "Too late, too late," my feet told me as they slapped against the stone. I couldn't tell where the screams came from. They were far away and echoing strangely through the castle hallways. I ran in the direction of the Charovnikov, past two staring maids who'd shrunk back against the walls, crumpling the folded linens in their arms. Kasha and I willed to go down the second staircase to the ground level, just as a white burst of fire crackled below, throwing sharp-edged shadows against the walls. The blinding light faded, and then I saw Solia go flying across the mouth of the stairwell, smashing into a wall with a wet sack noise. We scrambled down and saw him sprawled up against the opposite wall, not moving, his eyes open and dazed, blood running from his nose and mouth, and bloody shallow slashes dragged across his chest. The thing that crawled out of the corridor to the Charovnikov nearly filled the space from floor to ceiling. It was less a beast than a horrible conglomeration of parts, a head like a monstrous dog, one enormous eye in the middle of its forehead, and a snout full of jagged sharp edges that looked like knives instead of teeth. Six heavy muscled legs with clawed lion's feet sprouted from its swollen body, all of it armored in scales like a serpent. It roared and came rushing towards us so quickly I almost couldn't think to move. Kasia seized me and dragged me back up the stairs, and the thing doubled on itself and thrust its head up through the opening of the stairwell, snapping and biting and howling, a green froth boiling out of its mouth. I shouted, "Polzit!" stamping its head away, and it shrieked and jerked back into the hallway as a spurt of fire burst up from the stairs and scorched across its muzzle. Two heavy bolts flew into its side with solid, meaty thumps. It twisted, snarling. Behind it, Marek threw aside a crossbow. A terrified, gawky young equerry at his side had pulled a spear down off the wall for him and was clutching it, gaping at the monster. He barely remembered to let go as Marek snatched it out of his hands. "Go raise the guard!" he shouted at the boy, who flinched and ran. Marek jabbed the spear at the monster's head. The doors to a chamber hung crazily open behind him, white and black flagstones splattered with blood, and three men sprawled dead, nobles in slashed clothes. The white, frightened face of an old man stared out from beneath the table in the room, the palace secretary. Two palace guards lay dead farther back along the hallway, as if the monster had come bounding from deeper inside the castle and had smashed open the doors to get at the men inside. Or perhaps to get at one man in particular. It snarled at the poking spear, but then it turned away from Marek. It swung its heavy head around, teeth baring, deliberate, toward Solia. He was staring at the ceiling still, his eyes dazed, his fingers slowly scrabbling over the stone floor, as though trying to find a grip on the world. Before the thing could pounce, Kasia flung herself past me in one enormous leap down the stairs, stumbling and thudding into the wall and righting herself. She grabbed another spear off the wall and pushed it into the beast's face. The dog thing snapped at the spear's haft, then bellowed. Marek had sunk his spear into its flanks. There were boots, shouts coming, more guards running, and the cathedral bells ringing suddenly in warning. The page had raised the alarm. I saw all of those things, and could say afterwards that they happened, but I didn't feel them happening in the moment. There was only the hot stinking breath of the monster coming up the staircase, and blood, and my heart jumping, and knowing I had to do something. The beast howled and turned back to Kasia and Solia, and I stood up on the stairs. The bells were ringing and ringing. I heard them above my head, where a high window looked out from the stairwell onto a narrow slice of sky, the bright pearl-gray haze of a cloudy summer day. I stretched up my hand and called, "Kalmosh!" Outside the clouds, squeezed together into a dark knot like a sponge, a cloud burst that blew water in, splattering on me, and a bolt of lightning cracked in through the window and jumped into my hands like a bright hissing snake. I clutched it, blinded. White light
and a high singing whine all around me. I couldn't breathe. I flung it down the stairs towards the beast. Thunder roared around me, and I went flying back, sprawling painfully across the landing, smoke and a bitter sharp smell crackling. I lay flat, shaking all over, tears running out of my eyes. My hands were stinging and painful, and smoke was coming off them like morning fog. I couldn't hear anything. When my eyes cleared, the two maids were bending over me, terrified, their mouths moving soundlessly. Their hands spoke for them, gentle, helping me up. I staggered up to my feet. At the foot of the stairs, Marek and three guards were at the monster's head, prodding it wearily. It lay smoking and still, a blasted outline, charred black, against the walls around its body.
"Put a spear in its eye, to be sure," Marek said, and one of the guards thrust his in, deep into the one round eye, already milky. The body didn't twitch. I limped down the stairs, one hand on the wall, and sank shakily down on the steps above its head. Kasha was helping Soda to his feet. He put the back of his hand on his face and wiped away the maze of blood over his mouth, panting, staring down at the beast.
"What the hell is that thing?" Marek demanded. It looked even more unnatural, dead. Limbs that didn't fit with one another, hanging askew from the body, as if some mad seamstress had sewn together bits of different dolls. I stared at it from above. The dog muzzle shape, the sprawled loose legs, the thick serpent's body. And a memory slowly crept in. A picture I'd seen yesterday, out of the corner of my eye, trying not to read. "A Tsoglav," I said. I stood up again too fast and had to catch myself on the wall. "It's a Tsoglav."
"What?" Soda said, looking up at me. "What is a..."
"It's from the bestiary," I said. "We have to find Father Balo." I stopped and looked at the beast, the one last filmy staring eye. And suddenly, I knew we weren't going to find him.
"We have to find the book," I whispered.
I was swaying and sick. I scrambled and half fell over my body getting into the hole. Marek caught my arm and held me up, and with the guards holding spears ready, we went down to the Cherkovnikov. The great wooden doors were hanging askew over the opening, splintered, blood-stained. Marek tipped me against the wall, like a wobbly letter, then jerked ahead to one of the guardsmen. Together, they seized one of the heavy broken doors and lifted it out of the way. The library was a ruin. Lamps broken, tables overturned and smashed, only a few dim lights shining. Bookcases lay toppled over on heaps of the volumes they had held, disemboweled. In the center of the room, the massive stone table had cracked down the middle, both ways, and fallen in on itself. The bestiary lay open in the very center, atop stone, dust, and rubble. One last lamp shining down on the unmarred pages. There were three bodies scattered on the floor around it, broken and discarded, mostly lost in the shadows. But next to me, Marek went deeply and utterly still, halted. And then he sprang forward, shouting, "Send for the willow! Send for..." Sliding to his knees, next to the farthest body, he stopped as he turned it over, and the light fell on the man's face. On the king's face. The king was dead.
Chapter 23. There were people everywhere shouting. Guards, servants, ministers, physicians, all crowding around the body of the king, as close as they could get. Marek had set the three guards to watch him and vanished. I was pushed up to the side of the room, like flotsam on the tide, my eyes closing as I sagged against the bookcase. Kasha pushed through to my side.
"Neshka, what should I do?"
she asked me, helping me to sit on a footstool.
I said, go and get Alyosha, instinctively wanting someone who would know what to do. It was a lucky impulse. One of Balo's assistants had survived. He'd fled and pulled himself up into the stone chimney of the library's great fireplace to escape. A guard noticed the claw marks on the hearth and the ashes of the fire all raked out over the floor, and they found him still up there, shaking and terrified. They brought him out and gave him a drink, and then he stood up and pointed at me and blurted, "It was her! She was the one who found it!" I was dizzy and ill and still shaking with thunder. They all began shouting at me. I tried to tell them about the book, how it had been hiding in the library all this time, but they wanted someone to blame more than they wanted someone to explain. The smell of pine needles came into my nostrils. Two guards seized me by the arms, and I think they would have dragged me to the dungeons in the moment, or worse. Someone said, "She is a witch! If we let her get her strength back again!" Alyosha made them stop. She came into the room and clapped her hands three times, each clap making a noise like a whole troop of men stamping. Everyone quieted long enough to listen to her. "Put her down in that chair and stop behaving like fools," she said. "Take hold of Yakub instead. He was here in the middle of it. Didn't any of you have the wits to suspect he'd been touched with corruption too?" She had authority. They all knew her, especially the guards, who went as stiff and formal as if she were a general. They let go of me and caught poor protesting Yakub instead. They dragged him up to Alyosha, still bleeding.
"But she did! Father Balo said she found the book!"
"Be quiet," Alyosha said, taking out her dagger. "Hold his wrist," she told one of the guards, and had them pin the apprentice's arm to a table by the wrist, palm up. She muttered a spell over it and nicked his elbow, then held the blade beside the bleeding cut. He squirmed and struggled in their grip, moaning, and then thin black wisps of smoke came seeping out with the blood and rose to catch on the glowing blade. She rotated the dagger slowly, collecting up the wisps like thread on a bobbin, until the smoke stopped coming. Alyosha held the dagger up and looked at it with narrowed eyes, said, "Hulvad elolvita," and blew on it three times. The blade grew brighter and brighter with every breath, glowing hot, and the smoke burned off with a smell of sulfur. The room had emptied considerably by the time she was done, and everyone left had backed away to the walls, except the pale, unhappy guards still holding the apprentice. "All right, give him some bandages." "Stop shouting, Yakub," she said. "I was there when she found it, you idiot. The book was here in our own library for years, lurking like a rotting apple. Balo was going to purge it. What happened?" Yakub didn't know. He'd been sent to fetch supplies. The king hadn't been there when he'd left. When he'd come back, carrying more salt and herbs, the king and his guards had been standing by the podium with blank faces, and Balo was reading the book aloud, already changing, clawed legs coming from beneath his robe, and two more sprouting from his sides, tearing their way out. His face lengthening into a snout, the words still coming, even as they garbled and choked in his throat. Yakub's voice rose higher and higher as he spoke, until it broke and stopped. His hands were shaking. Alyosha poured more nalevka into a glass for him to drink. "It's stronger than we thought," she said. "We have to burn it at once." I struggled up off my footstool, but Alyosha shook her head at me. "You're overspent. Go sit on the hearth and keep watch on me. Don't try to do anything unless you see it's taking me." The book still lay placidly on the floor between the shattered pieces of the stone table, illuminated and innocent. Alyosha took a pair of gauntlets from one of the guards and picked it up. She took it to the hearth and called fire.
полжить, полжить малин, полжить тало.
And on further from there, a long incantation, and the dull ashes in the hearth roared up like the blaze of her forge. The fire licked at the pages and gummed them, but the book only flung itself open in the fire, and its pages ruffled like flags in the high wind, snapping, pictures of beasts trying to catch the eye, illuminated with firelight behind them.
Get back!
Alyosha said sharply to the guards. A few of them had been about to take a step closer, their eyes vague and caught. She reflected firelight onto their faces from the flat of her dagger, and they blinked and then startled back, pale and afraid. Alyosha watched with a wary eye until they moved farther away, then turned back and kept chanting her fire spell, over and over, her arms spread wide to hold the fire in. But the book still hissed and spat on the hearth like wet green wood, refusing to catch. The fresh smell of spring leaves crept into the room, and I could see veins standing out on Alyosha's neck, strain showing in her face. She had her eyes fixed on the mantelpiece, but they kept drifting downwards towards the glowing pages. Each time she pressed her thumb against the edge of her dagger, blood dripped. She lifted her gaze back up. Her voice was going hoarse. A handful of orange sparks landed on the carpet and smoldered. Sitting tired on the footstool, I looked at them, and slowly I began to hum the old song about the spark on the hearth, telling its long stories. Once there was a golden princess, loved a simple player. The king gave them a splendid wedding, and the story ends there. Once there was old Baba Yaga, house made out of butter, and in that house so many wonders. Tsk, the spark is gone now. Gone, taking the story with it, I sang it once through softly, and said, Kikra, Kikra, and then sang it again. The flying sparks began to drop onto the pages like rain, each one darkening a tiny spot before they went out. They fell in glowing showers, and when they fell in clusters, thin plumes of smoke went up. Alyosha slowed and stopped. The fire was catching at last. The pages were curling in on themselves, at the edges like small animals, huddling to die, with a burnt sugar smell of sap in the fire. Kasha took my arm gently, and we backed away from the fire while it slowly ate the book up, like someone forcing herself to eat stale bread.
How did this bestiary come to your hands?
One minister bellowed at me, seconded by half a dozen more.
Why was the king there?
The council chamber was full of nobles shouting at me, at Alyosha, at one another, afraid, demanding answers that weren't to be had. Half of them still suspected me of having set a trap for the king, and talked of throwing me in the dungeon. Some others decided, on no evidence at all, that shivering Yakub was a Rossian agent who'd lured the king to the library and tricked Father Balo into reading the book. He began to weep and make protests, but I didn't have the strength to defend myself against them. My mouth stretched into an involuntary yawn instead, and made them angrier. I didn't mean to be disrespectful. I just couldn't help it. I couldn't get enough air. I couldn't think. My hands were still stinging with lightning, and my nose was full of smoke, of burning paper. None of it seemed real to me yet. The king dead. Father Balo dead. I had seen them barely an hour ago, walking away from the war conference, whole and healthy. I remembered the moment too vividly. The small, worried crease in Father Balo's forehead. The king's blue boots. In the library, Alyosha had done a purging spell over the king's body. Then the priests had carried him away to the cathedral for vigil, wrapped hastily in a cloth. The boots had been sticking out of the end of the bundle.
The Magnati kept shouting at me. It didn't help that I felt I was to blame. I'd known something was wrong. If I'd only been quicker, if I'd only burned the book myself when I first found it. I put my stinging hands over my face. But Marek stood up next to me and shouted the nobles down with the authority of the bloody spear he was still holding. He slammed it down on the console table in front of them.
She slew the beast when it might have killed Solia and another dozen men besides, he said. We don't have time for this sort of idiocy. We march on the Ridva in 3 days' time. We march nowhere without the king's word, one of the ministers dared to shout back. Lucky for him, he was across the table and out of arm's reach. Even so, he shrank back from Marek leaning across the table, mailed hand clenched into a fist, rage illuminating him with righteous wrath.
He's not wrong, Alyosha said sharply, putting a hand down in front of Marek and making him straighten up to face her. This is no time to be starting a war.
Half of the Magnati along the table were snarling and clawing at each other, blaming Rosia, blaming me, even blaming poor Father Balo. The throne stood empty at the head of the table. Crown Prince Zygmunt sat to the right of it. His hands were clenched around each other into a single joined fist. He stared at it without speaking while the shouting went on. The queen sat on the left. She still wore Ragastok's golden circlet above the smooth, shining satin of her black gown. I noticed Dolly that she was reading a letter. A messenger was standing by her elbow, with an empty dispatch bag and an uncertain face. He'd come into the room just then, I suppose. The queen stood up.
My lords!
Heads turned to look at her. She held up the letter, a short folded piece of paper. She'd broken the red seal.
A Rosian army has been sighted coming for the Ridva. They will be there in the morning.
No one let out a word.
We must put aside our mourning and our anger, she said.
I stared up at her, the very portrait of a queen, proud, defiant, her chin raised, her voice rang clearly in the stone hall.
This is no hour for Polnia to show weakness.
She turned to the crown prince. His face was turned up towards her, just like mine, startled and open as a child's, his mouth loosely parted over words that weren't coming.
Zygmunt, they have only sent 4 companies. If you gather the troops already mustering outside the city and ride at once, you will have the advantage in numbers.
I should be the one who, Marek said, rousing to protest, but Queen Hannah held up her hand, and he stopped.
Prince Marek will stay here and secure the capital with the royal guard, gathering the additional levies that are coming in, she said, turning back to the court. He will be guided by the council's advice, and, I hope, my own. Surely, there is nothing else to be done.
The crown prince stood.
We will do as the queen proposes, he said.
Marek's cheeks were purpling with frustration, but he blew out a breath and said sourly, very well. Just that quickly, everything seemed decided. The ministers began at once to take themselves off busily in every direction, glad of order restored. There wasn't a moment to protest, a moment to suggest any other course. There wasn't a chance to stop it. I stood up.
No,
I said, wait. But no one was listening. I reached for the last dregs of my magic, to make my voice louder, to make them turn back.
Wait,
I tried to say, and the room swam away into black around me. I woke up in my room and sat straight up in one jerk, all the hair standing on my arms and my throat burning. Kasha was sitting on the foot of my bed, and the willow was straightening up away from me with a thin,
disapproving expression on her face, a potion bottle in her hand. I didn't remember how I'd got here. I looked out the window, confused. The sun had moved. You fell down in the console room, Kasia said. I couldn't stir you.
You were overspent, the willow said.
No, don't try to rise. You'd better stay just where you are. And don't try to use magic again for at least a week. It's a cup that needs to be refilled, not an endless stream.
But the queen, I blurted. The wood!
Ignore me if you like, and spend your last dregs and die. I shan't have anything to say about it, the willow said dismissive. I didn't know how Kasia had persuaded her to come and see to me, but from the cold look they exchanged as the willow swept past her and out the door, I didn't think it had been very gently. I knuckled my eyes and lay there in the pillows. The potion the willow had given me was a churning, glowing warmth in my belly, like I'd eaten something with too many hot peppers in it.
Alyosha told me to get the willow to look at you, Kasia said, still leaning worried over me. She said she was going to stop the crown prince from going.
I gathered my strength and struggled up, grabbing for Kasia's hands. The muscles of my stomach were aching and weak, but I couldn't keep to my bed right now, whether I could use magic or not. A heaviness lingered in the air of the castle. The terrible pressure. The wood was still here somehow. The wood hadn't finished with us yet.
We have to find her.
The guards at the crown prince's room were on high alert. They half wanted to bar us coming in, but I called out, Alyosha! And when she put her head out and spoke to them, they led us into the skelter of packing underway. The crown prince wasn't in full armor yet, but he had on his greaves and a mail shirt, and he had a hand on his son's shoulder. His wife, Princess Malgorzata, stood with him, holding the little girl in her arms. The boy had a sword, a real sword with an edge, made small enough for him to hold. He wasn't 7 years old. I would have given money that a child that young would cut off a finger within a day, his or someone else's, but he held it as expertly as any soldier. He was presenting it across his palms to his father with an anxious, upturned face.
I won't be any trouble, he said.
You have to stay and look after Marisha, the prince said, stroking the boy's head. He looked at the princess. Her face was sober. He didn't kiss her, but he kissed her hand. I'll be back as soon as I can.
I am thinking of taking the children to Gidna once the funeral is over, the princess said.
I knew vaguely it was the name of the city she was from, the ocean port the marriage had opened to Polnia. The sea air will be healthy for them, and my parents haven't seen Marisha since her christening. From the words, you would have thought she'd just had the idea a moment ago. But as she said them, they sounded rehearsed.
I don't want to go to Gidna, the boy said. Papa!
Enough, Stashek, the prince said. Whatever you think best, he told the princess, and turned to Alyosha. Will you put a blessing on my sword?
I'd rather not, she said grimly. Why are you lending yourself to this? After we spoke yesterday...
Yesterday, my father was alive, Prince Zygmunt said. Today he's dead. What do you think is going to happen when the Magnati vote on the succession? If I let Marek go and he destroys this Rossian army for us?
So send a general, Alyosha said.
But she wasn't really arguing. I could tell she was only saying it while she searched for another answer that she believed in.
What about Baron Golshkin?
I can't, he said. If I don't ride out at the head of this army, Marek will. Do you think there is any general I could appoint who would stand in the way of the hero of Polnia right now? The whole country is ringing with his song.
Only a fool would put Marek on the throne instead of you, Alyosha said.
Men are fools, Zygmunt said. Give me the blessing and keep an eye on the children for me.
We stayed and watched him ride away. The two small children knelt up on a footstool, peering over the windowsill with their mother behind them, her hands on their heads, golden and dark. He went with a small troop of guards for escort. His retinue, the eagle flag, in red on white, billowing out behind him. Alyosha watched silently beside me from the second window until they had gone out of the courtyard. Then she turned to me and said dourly, "There is always a price."
"Yes," I said low and tired, and I didn't think we were done paying.
Chapter 24. I couldn't do anything more just then but sleep. Alyosha told me to lie down right there in the room, despite the princess's dubious looks, and I fell asleep on the soft wool rug before the fireplace. It was woven in a strange dancing pattern of enormous curved raindrop shapes, or perhaps tears. The stone floor beneath was hard, but I was too tired to care. I slept the whole evening and night, and woke in the early hours of the morning. Still tired, but my head less thick, and my lightning-scorched palms felt cool to the touch again. Magic ran whispering and slow over rocks deep inside me. Kasia was sleeping on the rug at the foot of the bed. Through the bed curtains, I could see the princess with the two children gathered close to her. There were two guards drowsing on either side of the door. Alyosha was sitting up in the chair by the fire, with the hungry sword on her lap, sharpening it with her finger. I could feel the whisper of her magic as she ran the pad of her thumb near the edge of the blade. A thin line of blood welled up on her dark skin, even though she wasn't actually touching the steel, and it lifted in a faint red mist to sink into the blade. Her chair was turned to have full view of the doors and windows, as though she'd been watching all night. "What do you fear?" I asked her softly.
"Everything," she said. "Anything. Corruption in the palace. The king dead. Balo dead. The crown prince lured off to the battlefield, where anything might happen. It's late enough to start being cautious. I can miss a few nights' sleep. Are you better?" I nodded.
"Good. Listen to me. We need to root out this corruption in the palace, and quickly. I don't believe we made an end of it when we destroyed that book." I sat up and hugged my knees. Sarkhan thought it might be the queen after all, that she might have been tortured into helping instead of corrupted. I wondered if he was right. If the queen had smuggled out a small golden fruit somehow, plucked up off the ground in the wood, and now, in some dark corner of the palace gardens, a thin silver sapling had broken the earth, scattering corruption all around. It was hard for me to imagine the queen so lost to everything she'd been, that she would bring the wood with her, that she'd turned it on her own family and kingdom. But Alyosha said, she might not have needed much torment to help see her husband dead, after he abandoned her for 20 years in the wood. And perhaps her elder son, too, she added as I flinched in protest. I noticed Marek is the one she kept back from the front. In any case, it's safe enough to say she's at the center of what's happening. Can you put this summoning of yours on her? I was silent. I remembered the throne room, where I'd thought of casting the summoning on the queen. Instead, I'd chosen to give the court an illusion, a theatrical, to win Kasha's pardon. Maybe that had been the mistake after all.
But I don't think I can do it alone, I said. I had a feeling the summoning wasn't really meant to be cast alone, as if truth didn't mean anything without someone to share it with. You could shout truth into the air forever, and spend your life doing it, if someone didn't come and listen.
Alyosha shook her head. I can't help you. I won't leave the princess and the royal children unguarded until I see them safely to Gidna. Reluctantly, I said, Sole might help me. The last thing I wanted was to cast a spell with him and give him any more reasons to keep grasping at my magic, but maybe his sight would make the spell stronger.
Sole. Alyosha loaded his name with disapproval.
Well, he's been a fool, but he's not stupid. You may as well try him. If not, go to Ragastok. He's not as strong as Sole, but he might be able to manage it.
Will he help me? I said doubtfully, remembering the circlet on the queen's head. He hadn't liked me much either.
When I say so, he will, Alyosha said. He's my great-great-grandson. If he argues, tell him to come speak to me. Yes, I know, he's an ass, she added, misunderstanding my stare, and sighed. The only child of my line to show magic, at least in Polnia. She shook her head. It's cropped up in my favorite granddaughter's children and grandchildren, but she married a man from Venezia and went south with him. It would take more than a month to send for one of them.
Do you have much family left besides them? I asked timidly.
Oh, I have 67 great-great-grandchildren, I think, she said after a moment's thought. Perhaps more by now. They drift away little by little. A few of them write to me dutifully every midwinter. Most of them don't remember that they're descended from me, if they ever knew. Their skin has a little tea mixed in with the milk, but it only keeps them from burning in the sun. And my husband is 140 years dead. She said it easily, as if it didn't matter anymore.
I suppose it didn't. And that's all? I said. I felt almost desperate. Great-great-grandchildren? Half of them lost, and the rest of them so distant that she could sigh over Ragastok and feel nothing more than a mild irritation. They didn't seem enough to keep her rooted to the world.
I didn't have any other kin to begin with. My mother was a slave from Namib, but she died having me, so that's all I know of her. A baron in the south bought her from a Mondrian trader to give his wife consequence. They were kind enough to me, even before my gift came out. But it was the kindness of masters. They weren't kin. She shrugged. I've had lovers now and then, mostly soldiers. But once you're old enough, they're like flowers. You know the bloom will fade, even as you put them in a glass.
I couldn't help bursting out. Then why be here at all? Why do you care about Polnia? Or anything?
I am not dead, Alyosha said tartly. And I've always cared about good work. Polnia's had a line of good kings. They've served their people, built libraries and roads, raised up the university, and been good enough at war to keep their enemies from overrunning them and smashing everything. They've been worthy tools. I might leave if they grew wicked and bad. I certainly wouldn't put swords in men's hands to follow that damned hothead Marek into a dozen wars for glory. But Zygmunt, he's a sensible man, and good to his wife. I'm glad enough to help him hold up the walls. She saw the misery on my face, and with rough kindness added, you'll learn to feel it less, child. Or, you'll learn to love other things, like poor Balo, she said with a kind of dusty, wistful regret, not strong enough to call grief. He lived for 40 years in the monastery, illuminating manuscripts, before anyone noticed he wasn't growing older. He was always a little surprised to find himself a wizard, I think. She went back to her sharpening, and I went out of the room, sore and more unhappy than before I'd asked. I thought of my brothers growing old, of my little nephew Danushek bringing me his ball with his frowning little serious face. That face becoming an old man's, tired and folded and worn with years. Everyone I knew buried, and only their children's children left to love. But better that than no one left at all.
Better those children running in the forest, safe to run there. If I was strong, if I'd been given strength, I could be a shield for them, for my family, for Kasha, for those two small children sleeping in the bed, and all the others who slept in the shadow of the wood. I told myself that, and tried to believe it would be enough, but it was still a cold and bitter thought to have. Alone in the dark hallways. A few of the lower maids were just beginning to get the day's work underway, creeping quietly in and out of the nobles' rooms to stir up the fires, just the same as the day before, even though the king was dead. Life went on.
Solia said, "We don't need the fire tended, Lisbeta. Just bring us some hot tea and breakfast. There is a girl."
When I opened up his door, his fire was already up and mouthing a pair of fresh logs in a large stone fireplace. No small gargoyle-haunted cell of a room for him. He had a pair of chambers, each three times as large as the one they'd crammed me into. His stone floors were covered in piled white rugs, soft and thick. He must have used magic to keep them clean. A large canopied bed, rumpled and untidy, was visible in the second room through a pair of open doors. Along the broad wooden panel at its foot, a carved falcon flew, its eye made of a single, large, smooth, polished golden stone, with a black-slitted pupil staring out of it. A round table stood in the middle of his room, and Marek was sitting at it next to Solia, sprawled along and sulky in the chair with his boots up, in a night shift and fur-edged dressing gown over his trousers. A silver stand on the table held a tall oval mirror as long as my arm. After a moment, I realized I wasn't looking from some peculiar angle and seeing the bed curtains. The mirror wasn't showing a reflection at all. Like some impossible window, it looked out into a tent, the swaying pole in the middle, holding up the draped sides, and a front opening in a narrow triangle slice looking out onto a green field. Solia was looking into the mirror intently, a hand on the frame, and his eyes nothing but black wells of pupil, absorbing everything. Marek watched his face. Neither one of them noticed me until I was at their elbows, and even then, Marek barely glanced away. "Where have you been?" he said, and without waiting for an answer added, "Stop disappearing before I have to put a bell on you. Rosia must have a spy in this castle to have learned we were going for the Ridva, if not half a dozen of them. I want you by me from now on." "I've been sleeping," I said tartly, before I remembered he'd lost his father yesterday, and felt a little sorry. But he didn't look much like he'd been mourning. I suppose being king and prince had made them something other than father and son to one another. And he'd never forgiven his father, letting the queen fall into the wood. But I still would have expected to find him a little red-eyed, from confusion, if not from love.
"Yes, well, what else is there to do but sleep?" he said sourly, and glared at the mirror again. "Where the hell are all of them?"
"On the field by now," Solia said absently, without drawing his eyes away.
"Where I should be, if Zygmunt wasn't a lick-spittle politician," Marek said.
"You mean if Zygmunt were a perfect idiot, which he's not," Solia said. "He couldn't possibly hand you a triumph right now unless he wanted to hand you the crown along with it. I assure you, he knows we've got 50 votes in the Magnati already. And what of it? If he can't hold the nobles, he doesn't deserve it," Marek snapped, folding his arms across his chest. "If I were only there!"
He looked longingly at the unhelpful mirror again, while I stared at them both in rising indignation. So it wasn't just Zygmunt worrying the Magnati would give Marek the throne. Marek was trying to take it. Suddenly, I understood the crown princess,
why she'd looked sidelong at me. I was Marek's ally, as far as she knew. But I swallowed the first 10 remarks that came to my tongue and said shortly to Solya, I need your help. That won me a look from one of those pit-black eyes, at least, with an arched eyebrow to go over it. I'm equally delighted to help you, my dear, and to hear you say so. I want you to cast a spell with me, I said. We need to put the summoning on the queen. He paused, much less delighted. Marek turned and threw me a hard look. Now, what's gotten into your head? Something's wrong, I said to him. You can't pretend not to have seen. Since we came back, there has been one disaster after another. The king, Father Balo, the war against Rosia. This has all been the wood's design. The summoning will show us...
What?
Marek snapped, standing up. What do you think it will show us? He loomed over me. I stood my ground and flung my head back. The truth, I said. It's not 3 days since we let her out of the tower, and the king is dead. There are monsters in the palace, and Polonius at war. We've missed something. I turned to Solya. Will you help me? Solya glanced between Marek and me, calculations ticking in his eyes. Then he said mildly, The queen is pardoned, Agnieszka. We can't simply go enchanting her with no cause, only because you're alarmed.
You must see something's wrong, I said to him furiously.
There was something wrong, Solya said, condescending and complacent. I could have shaken him with pleasure. Too late. I had to be sorry I hadn't made a friend of him. I couldn't tempt him. He knew perfectly well by now that I didn't mean to make any regular occasion of sharing magic with him, even if I'd suffered through it for something important. Very wrong. That corrupted book you found, now destroyed. There is no need to imagine dark causes when we have one already known. And the last thing Polonia needs now is more black gossip flying around, Marek said more calmly. His shoulders were relaxing as he listened to Solya, swallowing down that poisonously convenient explanation. He dropped back into his chair and put his boots up on the table again. About my mother or about you, for that matter. The Magnati have all been summoned for the funeral, and I'll be announcing our betrothal once they're gathered.
What?
I said. He might have been giving me some piece of mildly interesting news, which concerned me only a little.
You've earned it, slaying that monster. And it's the sort of thing commoners love. Don't make a fuss, he added, without even looking at me. Polonia is in danger, and I need you at my side.
I only stood there, too angry to even find my voice. But they had stopped paying attention to me anyway. In the mirror, someone was ducking into the tent. An old man in a much decorated uniform sank heavily into the chair on the other side. His face pulled down on all sides by age. Jowls sagging, mustaches sagging, pouches beneath his eyes and the corners of his mouth. There were lines of sweat running through the dust caked on his face.
Savienna! Marek said, leaning in, fiercely intent. What's happening? Did the Rosians have time to fortify their positions?
No, the old general said, wiping a tired hand across his forehead. They didn't fortify the crossings. They laid an ambush on the long bridge instead.
Stupid of them, Marek said intently. Without fortifications, they can't possibly hold the crossings for more than a couple of days. Another 2,000 levies came in overnight, if I ride out with them at once.
We overran them at dawn, Savienha said. They're all dead. 6,000. Marek paused, evidently taken aback. He hadn't expected that. He exchanged a look with Solya, scowling a little, as though he didn't like hearing it.
How many did you lose? He demanded.
4,000. Too many horses.
We overran them, Savienha repeated, his voice breaking.